Blog Talk Radio.
I got a letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and burned that. Man, the way that I live don't concern that. Man, we gon' have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life. This is movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength. And if you know about the music, then you know about life.
Word is
any kind of activity that takes place on the floor of the Congress or the Senate, that's the government. Any kind of dilly-dallying, that's the government. Any kind of pussyfooting, that's the government. Any kind of act that's designed to delay, or deprive you and me right now of getting full rights, that's the government that's responsible. And any time you find the government involved in a conspiracy,
I can never go back. Life without parole, upstate, shackled and trapped. Living in the hole, looking at the world through a crack. Fuck that, I'd rather shoot it out and get clapped. I've gone too far, there ain't no coming back for me. Auschwitz gas chamber full of Zyklon B. Just like the Spanish exterminating Tainos, raping the black and Indian women, creating Latinos. Motherfucker, upmade me out of self-righteous hatred. And now you got yourself a virus, stuck in the matrix. A suicide bomber, strapped and ready to blow. Lethal injection, strapped down, ready to go. Don't you understand, they'll never let me live out in peace. Concrete jungle, guerrilla war out in the streets. Nat Turner with the sickle, pitchfork and machete. The end of the world, motherfucker, are you not ready?
DJ Tony Drake.
This is DJ Tony Drake, a.k.a. Mr. Top Shelf himself. And right now, you're in tune to Your World News, where journalism and activism are not mutually exclusive. Here on yourworldnews.org.
You can't tell me life was meant to be like this. A black man in a world dominated by whiteness ever since the Declaration of Independence. We've been easily brainwashed by just one sentence. It goes, all men are created equal. That's why corrupt governments kill innocent people. With chemical warfare, they created crack and AIDS. Got the public thinking these were things that black folks made. And every time this violence shown in the media, usually it's a black thing. So where are they leading you? To a world full of ignorance, hatred and prejudice. TV and the news for years they have fed you this foolish notion that blacks are all criminals, violent lowlifes, and then even animals. I'm telling the truth, so some suckers are fearing me, but I must do my part to combat the conspiracy.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News this August 16th, 2012. I'm your host, Solomon Kamajan, and we have another excellent, excellent episode in line for you today. We'll be talking with Professor Ron Wilkins, who will be joining us about 15 minutes after the hour. And if you're listening in the archive, it will still be 15 minutes after the hour. Just might not be 1 o'clock p.m. on August 16th. But this brother has written a powerful piece entitled Self-Hatred, Cultural Disorientation, Poverty, and the Gang Phenomena. And his His dossier, you know, reads a mile long. His brother has been involved in the Black Panther Party and SNCC. He's a professor and is first and foremost, is a dedicated activist who has spent much of his life with his boots on the ground, not simply posting things on Facebook, but has been really out in the community doing a lot of positive things. And also joined in the studio by, as you know, once in a while at Your World News, we have special guest hosts come on the program, you know, such as Nisa Williams in the past. Well, in that same tradition, we're joined in studio live today, August 16th, by Ayanna Harper, who is a recent graduate of the American School in Paris, and American University in Paris. And she's also a fellow Trinidadian. So, you know, yes, there's a little bit of family, you know, in terms of the Trinidadian family nepotism involved. But far beyond that, you know, it's an honor to have her in the studio because she's going to bring a lot of insight and perspectives that, quite frankly, even myself, you know, don't think about enough. So I want to welcome you into the studio, Ayanna. I don't know if you want to let our listening audience know a little bit something about you and any opening words that you want.
I just wanted to say, you know, thanks for having me on the show. I'm really looking forward to co-hosting with you. And like you said, I'm a recent graduate of the American University of Paris. So for the past 2 years, I've been living in France. And, I'm really looking forward to doing this show in particular because coming back to the States for the summer, I learned a lot about the African-American experience, which I, you know, didn't really experience growing up. And so it's brought a lot of insight to me and also exposed how important it is to, you know about, like, your history, know who you are, for all Black people, but in particular for African Americans, and you know, it helped me understand still the struggles that they go through, and I'm looking forward to talking to Ron about these things.
Definitely, and so I want to before we even bring Ron on, you alluded to something. I want to kind of get your perspective. You said that you know, as somebody you've studied much of your life outside of the U.S. In Europe, and obviously we know that you know some of the same issues exist there in terms of the mental struggles, you know, in terms of battling white supremacy and you know, African people, Black people, you know, breaking out of it and seeing their own self-worth and not always trying to compare themselves to a Eurocentric model, thinking that that is the best way to go and so forth. So what is your analysis of the role that white supremacy and just has played on the minds and consciousness of Black people, not just in the U.S., but I guess the world over?
The world over? Well, I would say that my experience living in Europe in particular, so I'm going to go to France and Belgium were the two places that I lived in for most of my life. And I would say that I think it plays a different role than it does in the States. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that in Europe there wasn't segregation as long as it was here. So, you know, people, there wasn't the, like Jim Crow and that kind of stuff, which, I mean, a lot of people's parents now experience, so there's a lot of hurt that still exists. Whereas in Europe, that it's so far removed that the issues, I feel like people have less issues about, you know, self-esteem or self-worth because of their race. Their issues are more because, for example, in France, they have a problem with not accepting foreigners into French society. They keep keeping them on the outside. And so, but it's never really addressed as something as, like, we don't want you in the society because you're Black. It's not really, like, about Blackness. And also, sometimes those people in and of themselves, it's a little different because they have a lot of ties to back home as well. You know, a lot of them are African immigrants. They still live in big communities with other African or Maghrebin-like people. So it's a completely different thing to being an African-American in which you're rejected by your own society, but it's the only one that you know. These people have been American for generations and generations. And they still don't feel maybe accepted enough or a tie enough to the only place that they know. So it's that is more detrimental to you as a being than if you have, you know, your roots somewhere else and maybe France isn't accepting you or whatever, but you have your roots in Africa. You still know who you are.
Right.
I think that that's one of the big differences.
Right, yeah. I can, yeah, definitely see what you're saying. It's, you know, especially when you look at some of the you know, European countries who, you know, have just a horrendous, you know, reputation of colonization throughout the world. You know, France, Britain, you know, they were controlling the economies, the land, and the societies of African people throughout the diaspora. So whether it was in Senegal or Sudan or Kenya, you know, or Congo, you name it, you know, yes, Congo, mentioned Belgium,
yeah.
You know, Senegal, France, you know, and so forth. And, you know, they literally, you know, it was the Berlin Conference that started in 1884 and concluded in 1885, you know, where they literally, you know, cut up, you know, they cut up Africa like it was a pie. And we see that also, you know, it had an effect in the Caribbean where, you know, Guadeloupe, Martinique, you know, Jamaica, Trinidad, you know, were all colonial states, whether it was France, Britain, you know, the Dutch, you know, yeah, Spain and so forth. And you know, that long legacy of colonization is very similar to, you know, what existed in Jim Crow era today, you know. And that's one of my good buddies, Obi Egbuna, you know, has started a project, you know, called Merging Our Experiences, where he looks at the experiences of colonization in continental Africa and comparing and juxtaposing that next to the experiences of not just slavery but Jim Crow so that American-born Africans don't allow that pond, the you know, that great body of water, the Atlantic Ocean, to separate them, to see them so farly separated from their brothers and sisters on the continent, that, you know, it's only because, you know your ancestors were brought over here that you're over here. You're still, in essence, you have African roots. You know, you're an American-born African. Some people say you're in Dominican Republic, that you're a Spanish-speaking African, you're a French-speaking African in Haiti, and so forth. And so I think it's a very important, you know, project. And I think some of those same themes we're going to get into with Professor Wilkins, you know, as we look at the impact that all these different things, and even looking at capitalism and how these things have played a role in self-hatred within black youth today. And we know that it definitely exists, that self-hatred exists not just with black youth, but even older, you know, Africans, you know. And for this, all intents and purposes, folks, you know, as you already know, when I say Africans, I'm referring to all black people as Africans, not just people that are currently living in the continent. So within that, you mentioned Africa, and I want to actually start with open up with a clip, as I usually do, from Glenn Ford and Black Agenda Report to kick off kind of our news segment. And then on the other end, I believe we'll be joined by Brother Professor Ron Wilkins, and we'll get right into this interview. So this is a recent piece from Black Agenda Report and Glenn Ford talking about the U.S.'s new imperialist strategy, you know, as it eyes the Eastern African nation of Eritrea.
Under the direction of the United States, the UN Security Council recently extended sanctions for another year against the Northeast African nation of Eritrea. The country of 6 million people, nestled against the Red Sea, is on America's hit list. In the imperial doublespeak of Washington, Eritrea is described as a destabilizing force in the region, which simply means the government in Asmara has refused to buckle under to U.S. military domination of the Horn of Africa. Back in 2009, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton threatened to take action, and by that she meant make war against Eritrea, if it did not stop supporting the Shabab resistance fighters in Somalia. There was no evidence that Eritrea was, in fact, arming the Shabab, and there is no evidence that Eritrea is doing so now, as the UN Monitoring Group on Eritrea and Somalia admits. The monitors, who are, in effect, tools of U.S. foreign policy, reported that they found no evidence of Eritrean aid to Somali fighters over the past year, and concluded that if such assistance exists at all, it is negligible. Yet the UN Security Council, under U.S. pressure, extended the sanctions anyway. Washington claims that Eritrea's alleged support for the Shabab has only halted because of the sanctions, and it's therefore too early to lift them, which amounts to punishing Eritrea for having the wrong intentions, whether it acts on them or not. It is, of course, not little Eritrea that is destabilizing the Horn of Africa, but the United States, which has made the region a front line in its so-called war on terror. Washington's closest ally in the neighborhood is Ethiopia, from which Eritrea won its independence in 1993 after a 30-year war. The U.S. instigated, armed, financed, and gave logistical support to Ethiopia's invasion of Somalia in 2006, plunging that country into what United Nations observers called the worst humanitarian crisis in Africa. Under American direction, Kenya also invaded Somalia in the midst of a great famine last year. The U.S. bankrolls, arms, and trains the nominally African Union force that occupies Somalia's capital and has turned neighboring Djibouti into the main base for the U.S. Africa Command, AFRICOM. And there sits Eritrea, surrounded by warring American puppets, interfering in no one's affairs, yet determined to defend her sovereignty, accused by the world's biggest and most aggressive power of destabilizing the region. Eritrea's real sin is to be one of the very few nations in Africa that do not have military relations with AFRICOM, the U.S. war machine. That puts a bullseye on her back, along with Zimbabwe and Sudan, which U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Susan Rice demanded be blockaded and bombed back in the George Bush administration. Barack Obama's Africa policy is an extension and expansion of Bush's aim to militarize the continent, and the much older U.S. policy to create chaos and horrific human suffering in those regions it cannot directly control. In practice, Obama's doctrine is the same as Bush. You are either with us or against us. Eritrea rejects that doctrine. That's why it is a target. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
And that was Brother Glenn Ford once again bringing us cutting-edge commentary and analysis that, quite frankly, the corporate media... There's good reason. You listen to that and you understand why, you know, we routinely play Black Agenda Report radio commentary, because it's critical analysis, it's news, it's information that the corporate media not just obfuscates, but for the most part just completely marginalizes. I mean, they have this information, but having that kind of perspective, that kind of analysis ruins the narrative that they want to put out there, the narrative that they've been in cahoots and have been consorting with the Pentagon, the State Department, to put out a routine narrative. And that's why I've said so many times before that the likes of MSNBC, it's not just Fox News. Fox News is kind of like that subterfuge that is, or not even subterfuge, but just kind of kind of a red herring, you know, that example that they put out there to scare folks to say, oh, man, Fox News. And then once you start to think that Fox News is like the lone villain, you know, on the airwaves, then you start to look at MSNBC and CNN as like these are safe refuges where I can get my news and my information and the critical analysis. And then before without ever even realizing it, you've been receiving similar narratives from them based on U.S. imperialism, and not seeing it, U.S. imperialism as a bad thing, but seeing it as, hey, this is what's needed. I mean, you know, President Afwerki in Eritrea, you know, he's a villain. We must go in there and we must, you know, take him out of power because he's threatening U.S. interests. And, you know, to a point, they're right. You know, he is threatening U.S. interests. U.S. interests has to do with global domination. It has to do with the usurping of other people's resources and securing so-called global strategic geographic locations and securing those locations so that they can continue their encroachment upon resources and controlling the region. We see that right now going on in the Middle East, and as they try to continue to encroach upon on Iran, and it's just like, what is, like, there is no end in sight to the greed and just the death and destruction that these folks have caused. And I'll turn over to you in a second, Ayan, is that you look at even, like, for instance, the narrative about, you know, close to 1 million civilians perished in Iraq, you know, caused by the U.S. and its NATO allies. That narrative is hardly ever put out there. The narrative that, you know, when the U.S. first started bombing Iraq, you know, the first, you know, few dozen strikes that they did, the aerial strikes that they did, did not even touch the so-called intended, you know, combatant compounds. They hit civilian compounds, and they took out men, women, and children, mostly women and children. That narrative is not put out there. And then when the narrative is put out there, it's put out there, well, this is collateral damage. This is what happens. We're trying to secure your safety, Ayana. We're trying to keep you safe, you know, within, you know, the borders of America. We're trying to the bad guys out there, and if we don't do these things, they're going to come for us. They're going to come for us. That's it. Yeah. There may have not have been any evidence before, but they're going to come for us. And so, living outside of the U.S., what do the average, I would say, Parisian, you know, or the average Frenchman or French woman, what do they think? And I know that there are some strong sentiments, you know, towards Sarkozy, who was in bed with the U.S., you know, for a long, long time. What do they think about war and imperialism in that way?
Well, people weren't at all pleased with the war in Iraq and that kind of stuff. A lot of it was because people just don't buy in the same way that I would say people do here, with, you know, their government just telling them something like, this is the enemy, we must go fight. There isn't that impulse to go to other places and just, you know, go fight almost blindly. So, you know, this when they came out with everything about, you know, the weapons of mass destruction and stuff, people in Europe didn't buy into it. I mean, England was the only one. Tony Blair, you know, he was on the American side, so he joined in to the war. But other places, I remember at the time, I lived in Belgium, and there were, you know, huge movements to boycott American products, you know, like, don't go to McDonald's, all that kind of stuff, demonstrations all over Brussels and in various parts, because people don't believe in that stuff, because it's in the end, going abroad and just fighting doesn't solve anything. And we can see that the issues that they opened, like, it's almost like they opened a Pandora's box in a way in the Middle East, and there was no foresight. You know, it was short-sighted. We're going to go over there and bomb these people. But then what happens in the long run? You have a lot of people that are angry at you. And I think that the impulse to go over and fight is not something that's in European society anymore. I'm not going to say it never was, because obviously they were the first, you know, colonialists. But at this point, it's not something that people just jump and do. People are much more reflective about, you know, what is it that my government is telling me. And, for example, even that whole thing with when Tunisia happened, France was in, the population was in uproar about the fact that, you know, the government was even talking about going over and bombing people. You know, it was just like, you can't be allies with these people, and then all of a sudden when global opinion of them changes, you change your mind as well.
Right.
People weren't pleased about that at all.
Right.
And they had ministers who got in a lot of trouble. One of them lost her job over it. No. So they have a different mentality, a different approach. There's a lot more thought that goes into it, I feel.
Yeah, that's really interesting, yeah, and because also with the whole Libya thing, I mean, France was, this is interesting, is that, you know, France, and you know, it's just a shame that, you know, it's really, you know, these global leaders of these countries that become like the face of the country.
Right.
But it really, okay, so let's say Sarkozy, you know, Sarkozy was very quick to do military strikes in Libya. And the interesting thing is that even before Muammar Gaddafi was brutally assassinated and put up on video, even before that happened, the oil fields and oil refineries, primarily in the eastern region of Libya, were at that moment being sold off by the NTC, the so-called National Transitional Council of Libya, these thugs that were hired by the CIA, by the British intelligence, and so forth. Those oil fields that provided social safety nets for Libyans, which made Libya the number one, they had the highest living standards in all of Africa, the highest living standards in all of Africa. Those were quickly sold away when they sold those to I believe it was Total or Elf, which are based out of France. Those oil refineries and those oil fields were sold off, and so now you look in Libya now. I mean, it's entrenched in a civil war, as soon as that civil war flared up, as soon as the end game happened for the U.S. and NATO allies, they got their troops out of there. They got them out of there. Like, it's almost like, yeah, let these animals like fight and kill themselves off. We got the oil fields, you know, in game, you know, game, set, match. You know, we're going home. You know, and I've said this before. These rebels, these so-called rebels in Libya, they were responsible for the racist targeting of black Libyans as well as black Africans from places like Mali that had found homes throughout Libya, and they were strong, you know, supporters of Gaddafi because of his stance in terms of letting them in and also apologizing on behalf of the Arab world for their role in the slave trade. And they were targeted. Women, you know, were brutally raped. They had their breasts cut off. You know, men were literally lynched and then, you know, cut down, you know, with cutlasses. So all this kind of stuff kind of happened. And actually, we got Brother Professor Ron Wilkins on the program, and I just want to reiterate, it would take me a long time. It would take Ayana a long time to read the bio of Professor Ron Wilkins, and that's simply because of the tremendous work that he's done the majority of his life. But as I said before, he's a former member of SNCC, the Black Panther Party. He's originally from L.A., and he's just done some incredible work, including but not limited to his work that he presently serves as the deputy chairman of the Harlem-based Patrice Lumumba Coalition, who Patrice Lumumba, as you know, is one of the heroes of Your World News. We have great deference for Patrice Lumumba, and he has taught Africana Studies and Social and Behavioral Sciences courses, and it's it's my great pleasure. To welcome on to Your World News, Professor Ron Wilkins. Ron, can you hear us?
Hey. Yes, I can hear. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you loud and clear. I'm here in studio with Ayana Harper, who's a recent graduate of the American University in Paris, and she's also a fellow Trinidadian. And we've eagerly anticipated your interview for a couple weeks now, so it's great to have you on the program.
Sure, it's great to be on. And look, I couldn't get you on my other line, so this is costing me an arm and a leg. But we'll try to put some time in. We'll give it a little time. I'll do the best I can. Okay, and it's
okay,
a real pleasure to be on. Thank you.
Definitely,
yes.
We'll try to try to get to our questions quickly then. So I just want to just lead off with a question. Can you tell our listeners about your background? Because I think your background, you know, will play a major role in helping them understand the following question that has to do with your article.
Well, just in brief, I mean, I was born in San Francisco, California, and at an early age, my family moved to Los Angeles, and I got involved with Slauson Village. Slauson Village, you may know, is the oldest of contemporary so-called gangs in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles, of course, has been widely seen as the what's called the gang capital of the world. Slauson was the largest, and we fought some of everybody growing up, and it was quite an experience being out there in the streets and the way I was. But with the Watts Rebellion in 1965, I was 19 years old, and it was a coming of age for me because we were fighting not only the L.A. Police Department, but police departments from every surrounding neighborhood, and eventually the National Guard itself. And it was a transformative event for me, and it caused me to begin to see the world very differently. And I was already gravitating toward the movement, and so soon after the rebellion, I got involved in a very serious way. Yes, I was in SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I was not in the Panther Party, however, but I was liaison between the central committees of the Panther Party and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. So that's been, so that's kind of the trajectory. I mean, I went to school eventually and got a degree and began to teach, and saw teaching as just another form of organizing, but doing it now from the classroom, helping young people become conscious of themselves and the larger world and what their responsibility happens to be. Yes.
Thank you, and thank you for the correction.
So, Mr. Wilkins, I just wanted to personally, thank you for being on the show and welcome you. And I just wanted to know, what prompted you to write your most recent article, The Self-Hatred, Cultural Disorientation, Poverty, and the Gang Phenomenon? What was, what made you feel like this needed to be something that you had to write on your blog?
Well, gangs, so-called gangs, are proliferating throughout the United States and in other parts of the world. It's not getting better. What's happening is a lot of our young people are losing their lives. And my being a kind of a veterano, so to speak, I've been around for a while. And, life is a teacher, and you have to live a while to figure some things out. And so because I'm a part of the movement and accept my responsibility for not only my past, but I have an obligation to future generations and those who are present. It's these are ideas that I put on paper that I've actually been thinking about for a long time. I speak a number of places, and I put the information out, but I had never sat down and put it on paper.
Okay.
And I decided to do it. I actually contribute to a website called The Sound Strike. It's called thesoundstrike.net. And
right.
I went beyond that. Not long ago, I also sent it to Davey D's Hip Hop Corner, who also publicized it. But I sent it to a number of other publications around the country, black newspapers and others, in this effort to try to help. I'm not surprised that none of them have printed it. None of them have printed it. And so it's good to be able to be on this program and to talk about it. Yes.
It's really reprehensible that none of them have printed it. And I want to actually ask you, because I got your article from a mutual friend that we have. Can I go ahead and print it on yourworldnews.org?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Please do.
You have my word on it. It will be up
thank you.
Before the end of the day today.
Thank you. Yes.
I had a little follow-up question about the whole thing with the gangs. I was wondering if you could just give a little breakdown of, what the gang started out as and, how they became what they are today, because it seems like there's quite a change from their inception to, essentially now the black-on-black violence and the bloodshed that we see, in the streets of certain cities.
Sure. What's interesting is with the article, you'll notice that the way it's printed, I put gangs in brackets.
Yeah.
So the whole point of a gang, and with Slauson started as a club. Slauson originally started officially in 1952, And in Los Angeles, you had very serious segregation, housing segregation. You had racial discrimination as far as the police, the terror of the police department. We had poor schooling and the rest. And so you also had white, I would call them real criminal gangs that preyed on black people. There was one in L.A., for example, known as the Spook Hunters, who were white, who used to attack us on the streets, and eventually we actually fought them and put them out of business, but that's a whole other story. But anyway, so we organized, and I wasn't there at the inception of SLOSS, and I moved into the neighborhood in 1960 and got involved, and so it was already ongoing, and I got caught up in it. But we saw ourselves as a club or a street organization. We never referred to ourselves as a gang. That's a system term. And so we never allowed the system to label us or to identify who we were. We were always about identifying ourselves. And in those days, we fought. And it was fighting other neighborhoods was more of a competitive thing. It was more like sport. And it's interesting because from about the mid-90s until now, on an annual basis, Slauson Village has a reunion in Los Angeles, and we have the reunion in honor of those who have gone but are not forgotten, and we invite our rivals, all these guys from other parts of the town of L.A. and beyond that we fought, and we reminisce about what we did in the past. We tease each other about how we used to ambush each other and so on. And we display in the park where we meet memory boards. We have the names of all of the members of our club from 1952 until now that have died, both men and women. And what's interesting is that more than six men out of roughly 300 on the memory board that were killed as a result of what we call gang violence, okay? And what has happened, though, is that in the so-called gangs of today, namely Crips and Bloods, because many sets in L.A. and around the country are affiliated with them, they've taken it to a whole other level. So it's not competitive sport-like competition and fighting where you really would best the other man and impress the women who were in the crowd and so on. It's now gotten very deadly, and it's just, people are blowing each other away. It's a very different thing. And I also want to add, the largest real gang on the planet is the United States military.
That's right.
Which is in every part of the world, dominating other people and moving, advancing the agenda of the imperialist United States, which is very much, we always say that the United States was founded on stolen labor, on stolen land and stolen labor, and that continues to be the case in terms of the way the military carries it out. So they're the gang.
That's right.
We never saw ourselves that way, yes.
That's right, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you, you mentioned that, contemporary gangs have taken it to a whole nother level where it's no longer about besting the other man, about sport. As you say, it's on a whole nother level. Can you, because within your piece, you talk about self-hatred, the self-hatred component that goes mm-hmm. into what you're talking about right now with that whole nother level, black men calling other black men. Can you kind of give us a contextual backdrop of what you mean by self-hatred and what contributed to that self-hatred?
I'm saying that we as young black men growing up in the United States become psychologically maladjusted because we've never had a cultural orientation, a historical orientation as to who we are as African people, mm-hmm. and that what happens, because we live in a very racist and white-dominated society, that in every area of life in the United States, it's the images are there, it's constantly reinforced that we are an inferior people, we are subhuman people, we come from a continent that has no history worth knowing anything about, that we were cannibals and savages and heathens and all of this. And this is reinforced in classrooms, on the big screen, on television, in religion, in the way holidays are celebrated, in the glorification of the U.S. military, in white values that get promoted. All the television programs that we watch, they're about white people. It's about white values and white culture. And when you see black people, we're clowns, we're comedians, we're performers, but we're gangsters, we're thugs. And the areas in the United States where that we call home are characterized as unsafe and poor and so on. And so it's constantly reinforced that we have almost no value, that we're very backward, and so that these, after a while, it sets in that when we actually began to see ourselves as inferior, and we're already full of anger, and we start engaging in these competitive activities, and which takes us to another level where we get to a point where in a fight, you're fighting someone else who looks just like you, who's from another neighborhood, who has done nothing really to you, but you fight him, and if you shoot at him, you're actually shooting at a mirror image of yourself. You've actually gotten to a place where you want to destroy this image that you've come to devalue and to hate. And that's what I mean in terms of self-hatred. It's not easy to understand it, but if you think about it, I mean, just last June, not last June, May of 2011, Psychology Today, a very respected national magazine, had an article. I got it right here in my hand, and it's titled, and this is from Psychology Today, it says, "Why are black women less physically attractive than other women?"
I saw this article.
You saw that, huh? It's deep. Saying that, and so what happens is that, so not only do the men black men have this problem, black women have this problem. And I mentioned in the piece, I talk about one of the most glaring examples of maladjusted black women is what women do to their hair.
Yeah.
Constantly burning and stretching it, getting expensive perms in their hair, trying to identify with white women.
That's right.
And putting themselves down. And this is in every continent. This is not just in North America and the United States. All over the world. Because we face all this discrimination and hatred. And I could go on talking about classroom examples in the public schools, whether it's the maps on the wall, the maps that are on the wall have Europe at the center, and
right.
Europe is larger than it physically is, than it actually physically is. They use these old maps rather than the Peter's projection map, which has been accepted internationally as showing the world in its true proportion. If you sit in a classroom and you're looking at the wall, a wall map, and the area of the world where your people come from is shown as smaller than it actually is, then you have a smaller perception of yourself.
Yeah.
You feel that you're less important, you're less significant. And all of these, in all of these areas, it's reinforced. I mentioned the point about religion, where they have Jesus in the churches is generally portrayed as someone white in Europe, and Jesus Christ did not come out of Europe, and the Jesus story is actually African in origin. The whites came to Africa and took it, appropriated it, and then whitenized the figures and the story and changed it all. And so if you believe that the most perfect human being, the purest person is white, then that also reinforces these notions of inferiority.
Yeah.
And so that's why all of this I tried to in a thumbnail sketch sort of way with the piece I touch on.
Yeah, I actually, I was really interested by this idea of self-hatred that you were talking about, because one of the things that it made me think about as well is the fact that, you know, what has been achieved is that now African Americans only see themselves through, you know, through the prism of how white people see them. So you now are imbibing everything that you've been told about yourself, and so then you believe that the only way to be black is, you know, by being this gangster or whatever it is that they are projecting onto you. And so a lot of the issues are that you have to break that down. You know, people have to understand that being black is only one aspect of who you are, and that there is no one way to be black. There's no one way to be any type of person. We're all the same. You can be any color and do anything, and your color doesn't define who you are, especially that you shouldn't define yourself in a negative way just because others are telling you that that's who you are. You know, there are lots of examples of black people throughout history that are not at all what, you know, is stereotypically projected as, you know, the typical African-American male or female. And that actually made me think of a TED Talk that I would advise some viewers, listeners, if they're interested, to listen to. It on YouTube. It's called The Danger of the Single Story by Chimamanda Adichie.
Yes, I've seen that, yes. Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what she's talking about, that, you know, you can't limit yourself to any kind of idea or preconceived notion about what a person is going to be like just because of the way they look. And that, I suppose, is the big problem that the African American community has, is that, you know, they've, like you said, imbibed everything negative that's been told about them and internalized it. And so,
I want to say this, and this is really important, and I put this in the piece. You know, Dr. John Henry Clark, a great historian, distinguished elder, before his passing, Dr. Clark said that when people oppress you, when people come in and enslave you, they destroy the memory of what you were before they interrupted your society. And that is what whites did coming into Africa. And when you know, when you study African history and African culture, and you look way back at early African society, there was such a thing known as honor and obligation. I respect you. I will not lie to you or cheat you or try to harm you because you're a fellow human being. To do that to you, to do any of those things to you, would bring dishonor on myself, my family, my clan, my tribe. And this is early African society. In an early African society, the family was paramount. The family was critically important. So there was loyalty to the family, and a man did not abandon his family. When a man took a wife, there was an expectation that she would be well-treated by others, and others in the community saw it that way. The children respected the elders. All these things happened. And so the violence that is destroying our communities today is nothing like early African society. And what I'm saying is that it's so important that that history be known by young people so that they know that this behavior, the character that they represent today, is not who they really are. And it's important that they reconceptualize themselves as African people. There are some things about African culture and about African history that is so important that we know, that is being withheld from us by those who dominate us.
Right.
Do you want to ask the question?
Yeah, so, well, you pretty much answered it, but I was just going to say that, you know, I'm sure that you think it's understanding your roots in African heritage that will basically help black youth become, you know, proud of themselves.
Yes, because what I say after self-hatred is that we're culturally disoriented.
Right.
We've never had an understanding of our history and our culture,
right,
of our customs, of our traditions, and of our ways of being, our ways of relating to one another. We lived in collective societies where we looked out for one another. You didn't go hungry and when there was food on my table. You were not homeless if I had a roof over my head,
right,
and so on. And these are the things that will help reshape our communities and turn them around. And, of course, the third factor I mentioned in the article, and I didn't give a lot of treatment to it, talk a lot about it, is that the whole question of poverty, that a even across the country. You know, so many of our people are living in desperate situations. And so a lot of the crime that gets committed is committed because people have simply no other means of supporting themselves. So people will sell drugs and hit someone else in the head and take what they have and so on because they do not have work. And I'm saying that leadership in society has to not only have imagination so that jobs are created, but that it also has to take some initiative. And we live in societies where people are simply discarded. We live in societies where there's an unequal distribution of wealth. That's the whole nature of a capitalist society.
Right.
It's the whole thing is greed. These are societies that don't have human priorities. And so all of this has to change. So to solve the problem, there has to be major things happen in terms of TV programming, in terms of movie production, in terms of what's happening in the educational system, in terms of the leadership in society. It can't be elections where it's Tweedledee or Tweedledum. It's got to be something. People have meaningful choices, and if the people who are put into office actually see to the needs of the entire population, then these are not the kind of societies that we live in. And so that's why we have the problem.
Right. I'm glad you brought that up. My question, because it leads right into my question. When you talk about the capitalist structure, we know that capitalism has European derivations to it, and we know that the U.S. capitalist structure today is one of the most rapacious and voracious in terms of appetite. I mean, it's profits before people, and that's why when you look at, for instance, the U.S. healthcare system, where 44,000 Americans die each year because they simply have no access to health insurance, and then you juxtapose that to, for instance, the revolutionary, the things that the revolution in 1959 in Cuba brought about, where Afro-Cubans, live 5 to 6 years longer than the average African American. They have access to healthcare. They everything is based on prevention, and it's people before profit. And my question to you was when we look at, for instance, these even when you talked about the so-called gang, quote unquote gang, you talked about how you and your comrades rejected the term gang because that was a term that was handed down and it was purposely obfuscated by Europeans, Euro-Americans to depict what you and your comrades were doing as if it was some kind of way it was socially deviant. So my question to you is do you believe that we need to, and not just black owned, but the right, because as we know, you can put a house Negro in front of somebody, and that that's not going to do us any better than the white person that was owning something before. But what do you think about? Are you alluding to part of our solutions that we need to as African people start to control more of the outlets that are putting out these images, but also the institutions such as schools, being in control more of the schools and the information that's disseminated within these inner city schools and even in some of the rural schools where, black folks are in Mississippi and Tennessee and so forth. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I'm saying that, but I'm also saying that what that needs to come out of is a serious mass movement. What's happening in the country is that just like right now, there will soon be another national election, and what most people most of the conversations have to do with are whether you go Democrat or Republican. I'm saying no, you build a movement. What needs to happen is we need to build a movement, and that's what is not happening. I'm one of those '60s guys, so in the '60s we built a movement. There were times we actually felt we had the system on the ropes, which is pushing it a little bit. But we really felt because you had serious numbers of people in the country thinking critically and in motion, taking action. And so that's what needs to happen so that we can move closer toward this vision of a society with human priorities and the notion of creating the new man and the new woman, where one's one is principally involved in work that is fighting against injustice, and that's what's needed. Let me just say something else. This is a little aside, but you were talking about health and Cuba and healthcare and so on. What's interesting, I recently shifted to a plant-based diet. This is a little off track, but part of the reason why people have so many health problems, we have problems with our heart, with our arteries becoming clogged, we develop all these cancers and so on, is because of all the meat that we eat and the way meat is treated and shot up with all, put it, injected with hormones and the rest. And so that's another reason why we have so many health problems, which needs to be addressed. And, of course, in the United States, which promotes the interests of the 1%, if I can say that, the people that have appropriated the national wealth and who are driven by greed and who daily profit off of the rest of us, they push the meat and the dairy products and so on. But these are the things that people need to be also looking at critically.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't agree with you.
Better life.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. I couldn't agree with you more, and especially on everything, not especially for anything, but you know, when you talked about the need for a new movement, that I completely agree with you on that. We need a new movement. This whole thing that African-born Americans think that it's some kind of significant social move for you to vote Democrat every four, six, 2 years simply because it's Democrat, thinking that there's some kind of sizable difference, you know, that's going to really seismically move, you know, the African community, you know, forward. It that has not worked, period. And we look, whether it's Obama or Clinton, they are the same warmongers that the Republican counterparts are. They expand
right.
The wars. They start new wars. You know, they take their orders from the same Joint Chiefs of Staff. And you're absolutely right. In order for us to see, you know, a world that is free of imperialism and war and this death and destruction, there has to be a new movement that is waged, and we have to think outside of this damn BS paradigm that exists within the two corporate parties. Because you mentioned capitalism, both those parties, the Democrats as well as the Republicans, have capitalist roots and have capitalist blood running throughout both those organizations, and that's why they control the national discourse, because even things with healthcare, the money that comes in, you know, year after year by the tens of millions, you know, from things like the health insurance lobby and so forth. The health insurance lobby wrote 2/3 of that so-called Affordable Health Care Act, and that's why it primarily benefits the health insurance lobby. And then when it finally kicks in 2014, 2015, there are still going to be 17 to 20 million Americans that are left without any kind of health care whatsoever. So I couldn't agree with you more, and I thought that was just a brilliant explanation that you gave, and I really appreciate that.
And look. Speaking of politicians, this Obama man, Obama led the NATO charge in the bombing of Africa, North Africa, of Libya. I mean, he outdid Bush.
Yeah.
So you know, I mean, these people they're serious about holding on to power.
That's
about
right.
Decolonizing Africa, because Libya was an impediment to what their designs are on the continent at this moment, and
right.
So Gaddafi had to go.
That's right.
But man,
that's
people
right.
have to. You can't just have some sentimental notion of, you know, some romantic idea that because someone has a black skin, you know, Slauson, Melvin X used to say that a change in the color of the slave master's skin does not change the essence of the state.
That's right. That's right.
And Melvin was so correct, you know. So yeah.
That's right. Because if we're going to get sentimental about skin color, then you know, I always say to those you know, those black folks that have this sentimental, you know, attachment just simply because the person sitting in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue is black, I'm like, then why don't you guys get all sentimental about Clarence Thomas and Condoleezza Rice and the great Buffalo Soldier, Colin Powell, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, they're different. I said, oh, really? How so? You know, but You know, I digress, but I, yeah, I appreciate that.
Thanks, yeah. Yeah.
Well,
yes, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, for those of us that aren't, you know, 60s babies and that sort of stuff, what do you think would be able to incite people to want to start a movement? Because, I mean, it is true that it seems like, you know, you need something sort of revolutionary to happen. But, you know, how can you get these sorts of things moving on the ground to, with enough effect that it's actually going to, you know, push the community forward and bring the community together to work together to better their position in society, I guess?
Well, you're already doing it because you're talking to me. I mean, and I'm not that I'm some know-it-all and I've got the whole grand plan, but you're talking this piece that I've done, no one that I'm aware of has come to understand and to explain this gang phenomenon in the way that it, so that people can properly understand it in the way that I have. If you go into prisons, they say that the way you turn men, young men around that have strayed is you give them the Bible. You know, you give them a job. You know, you have to deal with the whole ball of wax. You got to deal with a people's history and their culture, what they were before they got caught up in all this nonsense. One of the ways you do it, and as I said, you're doing it by, at least we talk about it on this program, but you'll also print the article. I teach, you know. I get into classrooms and teach the history. I think a very powerful medium is film, because we used to say that reading, we had the saying in the 60s that reading is a middle class habit. So that a lot of poor people simply don't read. They watch a lot. They do watch a lot of television. They watch a lot of film.
Yeah.
So if I had my life to live over again, I would make films.
Yeah.
There's some powerful films out there. I was just talking about health. There's a film called Forks Over Knives. I don't know if you're aware of it. It's called Forks Over Knives.
Great film.
Yeah, powerful film. That's what pushed me over the edge and said, I got to leave that meat and dairy alone. But, I mean, people need, if you show them films, because seeing is believing. So even in teaching in a classroom, I would bring in a lot of film and a lot of people, real people, to engage the students. But that's another way. And then after the film is shown, you the audience, and you say, okay, so what do you think of this? And people say, well, what I saw in the film is very similar to the situation that we're in. And then someone else will say, well, I think we need to meet and discuss this further. Somebody else will say, well, I'll offer my house. We can do it on Wednesday. And somebody else will say, well, I'll bring the food. But that's how you begin to organize and to begin to put together and begin to take action.
Okay.
But
I just wanted to thank you for joining us on behalf of Solomon and myself for joining us today, and we really appreciate it. And I wanted to say that you always have a platform here to have your opinions heard. And if you have anything else that you ever wanted to write and wanted to post, you know, Your World News will always be there to post it for you, to spread the word. And I just had one more thing to ask, if it was possible to have you give potentially an email address that you'd feel comfortable sharing with our listeners in case they wanted to talk to you directly about any of the issues.
Sure. You can reach me at rwilkins at csudh.edu. That's Cal State. That's for Cal State University, Dominguez Hills. .edu. So R. Wilkins at csudh.edu.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot, brother. And I just, as we were speaking, I went ahead and I was multitasking, and I made sure that I posted your article on Your World News, and I'll send you the link so that you can start sending it out to other folks. But I'm going to send it out broadly to not just our listeners, but We literally have thousands of people that frequent our website every week, and so that's thousands of new eyes that will be informed by the powerful information and perspectives that you have in that piece and future pieces as well. So thank you so much, brother, Professor Ron Wilkins. It's a pleasure, and to speak to an elder within our community like yourself.
Thank you, brother and sister. Thanks to both of you. Okay.
All right. Take care.
All right. You too. Bye now.
So, Ayanna, that was a really, really great. I mean, that far exceeded my expectations. My expectations were already extremely high. And, you know, I just wanted to kind of just ask you first your reflective thoughts on this interview and discussion that we just had with Professor Ron Wilkins.
Well, I mean, I think what I was most interested in was what he was talking about at the end, about the fact that, you know, there really does need to be a revolution or like a movement within the community, because it is true that it has to start within the community itself, because, you know, above, people are quite happy with the way that, you know, the African-American community is sort of kept down, so they're not going to help in any way to, you know, help the community then rise up. So it has to be something that's done within the community. And you know, like what he was explaining about the fact that, you know, these shows like this are of course going to help, because then people are more aware of the issues and that sort of stuff, but also educating children in schools about their heritage and the importance of knowing who you are before who you were and who you are, regardless of what it is that they are telling you you are or how you need to be. You know, that you can be grounded yourself and know who you are. And so, yeah, I think that that's basically the biggest message that I think comes away from his talk.
Yeah, I totally agree. And the insight that he has is somebody that came up, you know, that was part of, you know, Slauson's Village. And, you know, we were, you know, just watching that documentary in my class, as you remember, Bloods and Crips and, in Bassas of the Party. And, you know, I say Bloods and Crips because, I just remember that he was in, you know, Ron Wilkins was in that documentary, Bloods and Crips. But yeah, in Bassas of the Party, where, you know, they showed the origins of you know, the Bloods and the Crips, and how they, you know, they came out of the you know, Black Panthers and so forth, and that they in fact were fighting off these gangs, like real gangs of young white men that were terrorizing their communities, raping women, you know, doing all kinds of stuff, and they said, nah, not on our watch, and we're gonna come together and we're gonna whip your ass, you know, when you come through our communities, and you know, that's what they did. And so having somebody that was actually involved in that history, you know, it was really important. And I also think that, you know, when he broke down, just, you know, looking at, like, for instance, the African origins of Christianity, and how when in his article it talks about, you know, how our societies were based on human interaction. They were based on, you know, shared responsibility of different things, and that, you know, some of the societies, as you know, you know, being a scholar yourself, you know, that a lot of those societies were headed by women. They were matriarchal, and men had no problem whatsoever falling in line and following the directions and directives and leadership of women, because the precedent had already been set, because women were literally looked at as deities, because they were the givers of life, you know. So it just kind of emphasizes the importance of us also, like, returning to our stolen legacy. And when you understand your roots and your lineage, no one can come and tell you, you know, that your brown or your black skin is something to look down on. No one can tell you, because you're holding your head high as an upright man, as an upright woman, and you know that you come from greatness. So I just thought it was really, you know, really important. I want you specifically, Ayanna, to give me, and we didn't talk about this before the show plan, but I want you to specifically to listen to this clip attentively from Black Agenda Report, and I want to get your reaction to it, because I think that based on, you know, where you've been schooled in terms of the school system, I think that you'll be able to provide an excellent insight to this commentary by Glenn Ford on education.
President Obama this week told a White House audience honoring Teachers of the Year that elected officials have a particular responsibility, instead of bashing teachers, to support them. By his side stood Education Secretary Arne Duncan, who, as chief of Chicago's schools, waged holy corporate war on public school teachers, and now, with the enthusiastic backing of his boss, seeks to crush them as union members and as educational professionals nationwide. Obama is constantly holding forth about the need for America to achieve educational excellence, like Finland, which is top-ranked in the world. But a recent article in the Washington Post by Finnish educational leader Pasi Sahlberg makes clear that his country's success is rooted in a comprehensive national system that strives for equity, for equality of access to resources for all Finland's people. The United States, with the most striking social inequalities among the rich countries of the world, is simply not equipped to benefit from the Finnish model, and will never be until the U.S. is transformed as a society. Even the baby steps towards equity that Mr. Sahlberg says the U.S. must take to advance educationally are anathema to the corporate powers that be. Finland guarantees equal allocation of educational resources to all communities, rich or poor, requires by law that all kids have access to child care, comprehensive health care, and preschool, and it provides free education from preschool through university. These are prerequisites for general quality education and are non-existent in the United States. Teachers in Finland are respected professionals with the prestige of doctors and lawyers and a master's degree as a minimum. It is because they are so esteemed by society that Finnish teachers are the sole authority in monitoring the progress of students. There are no standardized tests in Finland. Yet, here in the United States, teachers are relentlessly hounded and degraded, made the scapegoats of society's inequalities by sharing low scores with their students, whose families and communities are cut off from America's wealth. Obama's corporate privatization campaign relentlessly seeks to deprofessionalize teachers, to replace them with young, essentially temporary employees who have no intention of making teaching their life's work. With that kind of self-destruct mechanism, the U.S. will be lucky to remain in the global second tier of education also-rans. Mr. Sahlberg keeps returning to the principle of social equity as an educational necessity. You can't just keep shouting, "Excel, excel," when the resources and support systems that would allow all children to reach their potential are hoarded by the rich and largely segregated by race. The Finnish educator did not mention Finland's ethnic homogeneity, that its population is 93% Finnish and the next largest group is Swedes. Sahlberg is a kind of diplomat as well as a teacher. But here is the truth. The lack of a social compact in the United States has crippled the society in myriad ways, including its inability to take even the first steps towards educational equity. That absence of a social compact is rooted in white supremacy. Racism is why Deshaun can't read, and why Chip isn't doing very well on a world scale either. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
So I'll let you take that away, and I believe you also just received your college education for free.
No, I didn't, because I went to the American University of Paris. But my sister, who goes to an architecture school, which is one of the Ivies, let's say, of Paris. It's not exactly free, but she pays 500 euros for the year.
For the year.
So I mean, you know, for all intents and purposes, that is essentially free, you know. And well, I think what was interesting is that was mentioning about equality, and I mean, I was going to say that's pretty much what the schools I'm thinking about in France in general are about. Like, across the board, all the schools are pretty much the same, the public schools. So, for example, if they grade out of 20, if you have a 16 in Lyon, it's the same as a 16 in Lille, it's the same as a 16 in Paris, it's the same as a 16 in Grenoble. One of the things that shocked me when I came to the States is that an A means nothing. There's no uniformity of the grading system of the schools across the board. So you actually have no idea what that means on a larger scale, where you stand. You know, even within university, you'll have one teacher who puts an A here, it's easier to get an A with them, or it's easier to get an A with another. Whereas when things are uniform, you have to do it this way to get those grades. So if people have an average of, like, you know, 16 or whatever in France, everybody in the country can understand what kind of achievement that is. Whereas here, you can have a 4.0, but depending on what school you went to, what it is that you had to do, you may have done a lot more than someone else. And, you know, everything is, you know, just, well, I want so-and-so to have this internship, you must have a 3.2. But what does that really mean on a large scale? Because, for example, the school that I went to here in high school for the last 2 years, we did the International Baccalaureate,
right,
which is considerably harder than the AP, for example.
Right.
And so when I went to school in New York for a little while, and I wanted to get exempt from having to do a language requirement. They wouldn't accept my International Baccalaureate French grade, but they accepted the AP that I did. And they just told us to come into school on this day, and we did the AP one time, everyone got 5. The IB, it takes us 2 years to do,
right,
of intensive work.
Right.
But they would, if I hadn't done the AP, they wouldn't have accepted it, as though my score is substandard to someone's AP. And, you know, it's just these kind of things that are amazing. And I'll never forget the first time I sat in that SAT. I had never seen a Scantron also before coming to the States. That was like, you know, I just had no idea what that was. But sitting in the SAT and they tell you that this is an opportunity to show on an even playing field what you have learned. And I was like, I didn't go to SAT school for 18 years. So what my grades in school should be enough to reflect what I've learned.
Right.
But since there is no across-the-board sort of standardization of anything in the schools, you have to have something like the SAT. And even those are not fair. They're biased. You know, you have to be able to pay for all, you know, the Kaplan or whatever to go, which are extremely expensive. And all they do is teach you how to pass the test. It's not even about, you know, actually learning anything.
That's right.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just a different approach to education. It's more about, like, you know, streamlining people into where you're about to be in society when you come out of school, you know?
Right. And so if some of your friends who are you know, French citizens, if they wanted to go to a state school in France, that's free.
Yeah, yeah. And also the other thing is that France gives people, like, scholarships, so a lot of those students essentially are being paid to go to school because you get the scholarship that covers maybe 500 euros or whatever, and then you have sort of an allowance to go with that, you know. So they're well looked after.
Right. And then so you see here where, and I think we talked about this a few times in class, is the fact that because Americans are purposely sheltered from understanding other societies and how other societies work,
right,
because they're sheltered that, that's why so many don't ask for what is, you know, is deservedly so, you know, should be given to them. You know what I'm saying? That they should be able to feast on these things, you know, coming from this so-called most opulent, you know, nation in the world, where if French students or students in the UK or say students in Canada, if they were faced with what the average American student is faced with when they graduate from college, having to graduate from college on average with $24,500 in debt, they would burn the place down. They would burn the place down. But since American students, like their parents, have been so sheltered, they just they accept it. They think that, hey, you know, and it breeds that kind of American exceptionalism, like, you know, which is what you saw when you went to that school in New York. Is like that exceptionalism is like, oh, you're back, Latoria. Oh, you know, this is the basis. The world revolves. We are the sun. The world revolves around United States of America and our educational system.
Right.
You know, as flawed as it may be, and they're not thinking it's flawed, but as flawed as it is, you know, they think that it revolves around it. So your baccalaureate, your IB, your international baccalaureate, no way, you are gonna have to adhere to this substandard AP requirements, and that's that. And so, you know, but my point is, American students, they finish. They're in debt to their eyeballs. Some spend the rest of their lives having to pay off their student loans, and walk around. And because they paid so much money and they owe so much money, they literally, a lot of them have now become like these academic elitists and think that, oh, because I have this degree, because I paid this money for this degree, you know what I'm saying? I am better than you and you and you and you. But at the same time, the rest of the world is looking at them and laughing, like how silly you are to take that, to take having to pay tens and tens of thousands of dollars for your education. Meanwhile, your government lies to you and says it's not possible, but we know it's possible because they spend $1.2 trillion on military expenditure every single year. It's just that you are not a priority. Global domination, capitalism, you know, the bottom line, that is the priority, not your education, because we want you to come out, and it is a debtor society. We want you to be in debt and to have to pay off the corporations that we're in cahoots with. No. Are you kidding? Are you kidding us? Like, to come out and to owe nothing and to be contributing to the economy right away? No. For God's sakes, what would that do to the corporations that finance us? You know what I'm saying? What would that do? So it's just. And another question I want to ask you is how many of your friends who are French, how many of them and their families have to pay for health care?
None.
Why is that?
Well, because it's. It's just a right. You have free health care. So
it's a right, not a privilege?
No, it's a right, not a privilege. But a lot of it is also that when you go to the doctor, even if you have to pay for things up front, it's like reimbursed. So they even give you the sheet, you know, it's reimbursed and stuff, and then you send it in, and then they reimburse most of it. Even if it's not all, it'll be like over 60%. And so, yeah, things cost a lot less in Europe. Even if things aren't reimbursed, Their prices are not inflated, so that you aren't paying, you know, ridiculous amounts. And there's no copay, for example, when you go to the doctor and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's not something that you have to be, you know, worried about, that if you get sick, you're not going to be able to go to the doctor.
Right.
Or that it'll cost you so much that it'll be, you know, such a problem that, you know, you might just have to just sit at home and deal with whatever you
want. And so how is that paid for? How is that possible? What is it, through taxes or
it's through taxes, because people in Europe pay higher taxes than you do in the States, and so that's usually something that a lot of people like complain about. You know,
what you get in return.
Exactly, that's the thing, is that, you know, at least people in Europe for the most part like can say that they know where their taxes are going.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm paying higher taxes, but then there are a lot of things that I don't have to pay for. So, you know, or that are completely taken care of. My children can go to a good school all the way through to tertiary education. You know, they can, like, for example, my mom was actually talking about when we were born, because we were born in Paris. And she said, you know, you have there's a woman that will come to the house and make sure that the mother understands how to take care of the child. If you don't, you know, they take you to the clinic. You know, they come and do all these checks. All these things are free.
Right.
You know, you don't have, and this is someone who is, well, I mean, it's from the state, because everything is state-owned, state-governed,
right,
who comes to make sure that you are able to take care of your child and all that kind of stuff. You don't have to worry about any of that. It's not, you know, coming out of your paycheck and
right,
all that. Yeah, and so it's just a different way of thinking. It's just that the countries are run for the people, because that's what makes your country.
And what we see, and when the government even threatens to take away some of those,
oh, yeah,
those rights, people like take to the streets, like, are serious, right?
Yeah. No,
think, right?
Every other day in Paris, there's a strike.
Really?
Yeah, no, actually, there's strikes all the time. The minute people get upset, they take to the streets.
And it's crazy, like here, it's like,
yeah,
it's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's what I always find that is like, that's quite strange about here too. You know, people just complain, but you don't really do anything about it.
Yeah.
But then also that I think it's easier to go on strike in France. There aren't going to be huge ramifications or consequences, the same that there would be here. You know, I think that if people go on strike and stuff here, you know, you have the possibility of, if you have to end the strike, not having a job.
Right.
Because people have to work, so it's a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
Because you have no safety net, so you know, even going on strike is a huge liability.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I guess that's why unions are so much more powerful, like so much more, I'd say unified in a lot of ways there than they are here. You look at it was like a little over a year ago where throughout London there was 63 different unions that took the streets for like a work stoppage day, and there were 2 million workers got on the streets and were marching. I mean, that's unbelievable. That's incredible. I mean, you even look at, like, so you compare that, for instance, like with the Occupy movement here, which, you know, it's completely, you know, supported in a lot of ways, you know, not, you know, completely perfect, but supported in a lot of ways, but that the Occupy movement has pretty much fizzled off. I mean, it's
yeah,
pretty much fizzled off.
Yeah.
You know, where, you folks, you know, in other countries, Europe, and even other in countries beyond Europe, I mean, they get out and like, yo, we're gonna stay in the streets for as long as it takes. I mean, look what's going on in Greece right now. I mean, those folks are not pleased with the government. The government's austerity measures, and they are out in the streets, and unfortunately, it's gotten bloody, and some people have gotten, you know, really, really hurt bad. I mean, there's been, you know, self-immolation, but folks are, you know, they don't want to see these safety nets held, because they see them as, like what you said before, a right, not a privilege. So even this, like, political arena here in the U.S., they refer these things as privileges. Like,
yeah,
it's a privilege. No, I think healthcare should be an inalienable human right. It's a right, you know, so... Ayana, I want to thank you for coming on, but I'm going to leave it at thank you, because as we know, you're going to be coming on and doing more shows with us. You're going to be here in the States until January, so look forward to having you on and contributing to Your World News a lot more. It's going to be fun. This was a really good episode, and I like your vibes. I like the chemistry. Yes, she says that she was born in Paris, but she's Trinidadian. Trust me on that. You know, trust me on that. She's Trinidadian. Her parents are Trini. She spent a lot of time in Trinidad as well, and Trinidad, that's good enough for us. So we claim you. You know. So I want to thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much for having me.
No problem. And we're gonna have, since we were talking about guns and the impact of violence and gangs and so forth, I'm going to let Guru and Primo, otherwise known as Gangstar, take us out with this classic track from their album, Hard to Earn, Tons of Guns. Until next time, on behalf of Ayana Harper, I'm Solomon Kamajan. See you next time on Your World News.
Violence is wrong in America. Violence is wrong abroad. It's wrong to be violent. Defending black women and black children and black babies and black men. Then it's wrong for America to draft us and make us violent abroad in defense of her.
Tons of guns, everybody getting strapped. Tons of guns, gotta watch the way you act. Tons of guns, real easy to get. Tons of guns, bringing nothing but death. Tons of guns are in the streets nowadays. It's big money, and you know crime pays. Check your nearest overpopulated ghetto. They greet you with a pistol, not trying to say hello. Mad kids packed, cause the neighborhood's like that. Want some shit that's fat, catch a victim to a stick. Kids pulling triggers, niggas killing niggas. 5-0, they sitting waiting, tally death toll figures. It's crazy, there ain't no time to really chill. Jealous motherfuckers always wanna act ill. 22s, 25s, 44s, 45s, Mac 11s, AKs, taking mad lives. What the fuck you gonna do in a situation? It's like you need to have skills just to feel relaxation. tons of guns. Shot him 16 times, so there he lay. You can pray for the shit to like cease, but until then, a nigga's gonna pack a piece. And yo, the devil's got assassination squads. Wanna kill niggas cause they're scared of God. They got camps where they train, they learn to take aim at a nigga like a piece of game. And I'm not seeing that. Them days are gone, cause now we got crons to put them where they belong. Give me a rude boy from a little Brooklyn. Fuck the bullshit, pain and suffering. I'm coming off with a foolproof plan. As if each and every lyric was worth $100,000, I stand in the face of hatred, letting off mad shots, making devils run naked. Tons of guns. Tons of guns, everybody's getting strapped. Tons of guns, gotta watch the way you act. Tons of guns, real easy to get. Tons of guns, bringing nothing but death. Tons of guns, but I don't glorify. Cause more guns will come, and much more will die. Why? Yo, I don't know, Black. Some motherfuckers just be living like that. They like to feel a chrome in their hand. The shit makes them feel like little big man. 12 years old catching wrecks. Cause there ain't no supervision putting kids in check. People get wounded, others they perish. And what about the mother and the child she cherished? The city's wild, upsets the wild child. Tension, anger, living in danger. What the fuck you gonna do in a situation? It's like you need to have still, just to feel relaxation. Tons of guns. 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 Tons of guns.